How's everybody eat, huh? So Parshas Vayetze is actually a very, very active Parsha. Many, many things happen. Remember what happened here, that Yaakov Avinu, by deception, apparent deception, took the blessings that Yitzchak was going to give to Esav, and instead Yaakov got those blessings. As a result, Esav is very angry. Esav wants to kill Yaakov. Yaakov's life is in danger. In addition, Yaakov needs to get married, and this initiates the whole series of events that causes Yaakov to leave Beersheba and go to Haran, go to Mesopotamia, which is the ancestral home of Avraham Avinu. First, I spoke Friday night, so I'm going to repeat a little bit. Some of you, I mean, I think most of you were not there. This whole idea of the brachos and the deception, you know, it's very, very strange that Yaakov Avinu is identified as the penultimate man of truth. The Navi describes Yaakov as embracing the Midah of Emes, the Midah of truth. And the whole story, again, this is a very, very psychologically dense and complex story. The whole story of Yaakov getting the blessings by deception raises at least three distinct questions. There are three questions about that. Question number one is, how could Yaakov lie? Yaakov is the man of truth. You know, people say, by the way, that this is one of the outstanding proofs that the Torah comes from God. Because if we were writing our own story, we would in no way portray ourselves like this. I mean, how are the Jewish people portrayed? You know, we lie and we cheat and we do this and we do that. You know, if you're writing your own history, you know, you build yourself up. If it comes from God, then everything is true and everything is objective, including the warts. But question number one is, how could Yaakov lie? Question number two is, how could Yitzchak be fooled? In other words, Yaakov on one hand lies. Yitzchak on the other hand seems not to know what's going on in his own family. He wants to give the brachas to Esav. He thinks Esav is the righteous tzaddik who deserves a blessing. And question number three is also a question, and that is that a bracha is not like a magic wand. If Yitzchak blesses, and his intention is the blessing should go to the man that is Esav, the fact that another man called Yaakov is standing in front of him, it's not like a ray gun that, you know, the rays hit me. The bracha was intended for Esav. If the bracha was intended for Esav, then why should it go to Yaakov? Because Yaakov engaged in deception, right? So these are three distinct problems. How could Yaakov lie? How could Yitzchak be taken in by naivete? And third, if Yitzchak intended that a bracha be given to Yaakov, to Esav rather, then how could it be chal? How could it take effect on Yaakov as a result of deception? Now, coming to the first issue of how could Yaakov lie, so here there's an interesting, this is not going to be a complete answer, and this is why we think about these things over and over and over again every year, right? The Torah is inexhaustible, and we're always going to have questions. And by the way, right after we have this question, we're going to hear in a few weeks Mechiras Yosef, right? So Sefer Chumash Bereishis is filled with all sorts of questions that we never really get to the bottom to, because in Torah you never get to the bottom of anything. And that is, one of the central concepts in the book of Bereishis is the concept of nisayon. Nisayon is to be challenged. And the framework of nisayon is always to do exactly what is the opposite of your natural tendency in the service of God. Because if you're serving God simply because that is how your nature works, you're not really serving God, you're simply following your personality. So for example, if you're a person who loves to sing and dance, so when you're singing and dancing on Simchas Torah, that's a great thing. But it's not a complete Avodas Hashem, because this is what I like to do. But if you're morose and pessimistic, and you hate to sing and dance, but it comes Simchas Torah and you say, this is what Hashem wants me to do, so I'm going to celebrate. That's avoda. Right? Some people, again, and I'm not being facetious, some people, again, this sounds bizarre, but it's not so bizarre. Some people like Tisha B'Av more than Purim. What do you mean, like Tisha B'Av? Tisha B'Av is a sad day of Chorban. That's true. Of course it's a sad day of Chorban. But they feel closer to Hashem in a more serious, somber atmosphere. It's more meditative. It's more conducive to Cheshbon HaNefesh. So spiritually, they extract from Tisha B'Av more than the raucous, you know, joyous expressions. Other people are Purim Jews. So Rav Huttner used to say that the test of a real Jew is that you do cry on Tisha B'Av and you dance unrestrainedly on Simchas Torah, because you do what Hashem wants you to do in all of the times of the year. So Nisayon means going out of, to use the modern phrase, going out of your comfort zone. That's kind of the modern words that we use. Thus, Avraham Avinu's natural way of serving God was through loving kindness. So what was his big Nisayon in life? To take his son and be willing to kill his son as a korban for Hashem. This was not called a test of Yitzchak, even though Yitzchak was the sacrificial lamb. Because for Yitzchak, whose midah is inner strength, to give his life for God, that is what Yitzchak does. But for Avraham, whose whole service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was loving kindness, to conquer his natural inclination. This is besides the inclination of a father to a son, which of course is powerful. But you have to understand that for Avraham, his whole relationship to God was based on perceiving God's kindness in the creation. And Avraham was emulating what he saw in God. And yet Avraham's tests, all of them involve cruelty in one level or another. Leave your aged father and come to the land of Israel. Set away, expel your son Yishmael, because Sarah's right. And finally, kill your son Yitzchak. What is God saying? God is saying, you got to go beyond your comfort level. You got to stretch yourself. You got to serve God in ways that are absolutely contrary to your nature. Because only then are you serving Hashem and not simply doing what you're comfortable with. This is the concept of Nisayon. And if you remember, the Ramban made the point that although the word Nisayon means test, it is not really a test in the sense that God doesn't know and he needs to test us, but rather Nisayon is the concept of taking potential and actualizing it. Hashem knew ahead of time that Avraham would pass the test. But until Avraham does it, he doesn't become the person he's able to become. You understand the concept here? In other words, a Nisayon is God's structure to actualize a potential that would otherwise be dormant within us. Okay, it is not to inform Hashem in any particular way. Hashem knows the future. It is the actualization of potential. Meaning, the same thing in learning. Somebody says, I could finish Masechah Sukkah if I wanted to. Well, that's great. You know, maybe you could. But there's a very big difference between I could have done it and I did it. Right? Before the Akedah, Avraham could have passed the test. But he didn't become what he became till he actually passed it. Now, if you understand that the idea of Nisayon is going against your nature, I'm going to skip Yitzchak for a moment. Then if Yaakov's outstanding attribute, paradoxically, is the attribute of emes, the attribute of truth, the test that God shows him is, I'm going to create a scenario where you must be willing to serve me, even by lying and deception, if that becomes necessary. Now, this is a very rare scenario, and I'll elaborate on this. Normally, Hashem doesn't want us to serve him by lying or deception. But we have to be ready. If that is what God requires in a given circumstance, then indeed we have to go against our midah. Now Yaakov didn't want to do this. Yaakov repeatedly said to his mother that, I will be cursed by my father. I am committing a sin to God. Because you have to understand that Yaakov, according to Chazal, was the quintessential person of emes. Emes. And yet, sometimes you have to lie for God as well. Now, again, do not misunderstand this. Generally speaking, Hashem hates lies. Hashem hates deception. But there are going to be times in which one has to lie. And if that is the case, one lies with the same joy that one tells the truth, because one is doing the Ratzon Hashem. Yeah.
Doesn't this situation show a lack of emunah on Rivka's behalf, though? She went to Shemayim, she got the prophecy, which right. said that, and it was a positive prophecy, that the good
yes.
would conquer the other, so it had to play out that way. So why did she feel she had to?
Well, once again, that's an excellent point. Rivka was told by Shem and Aver that the younger shall dominate the older, meaning the brachas will go to Yaakov in some ultimate sense. Yitzchak apparently didn't know that at all. Right, that's a good question. Why didn't she tell Yitzchak that bracha? But once again, she sees what's happening. So we do have a responsibility. In other words, even when there's prophecies, we do have a responsibility to do hishtadlus. And this was her hishtadlus. But I think as I go on, I think I'll give you an answer for that question as well. So one perspective of the story is that Yaakov, as it were, has to overcome the Midah of Emes, because that becomes necessary. But we'll come back to this. What's Yitzchak's Nisayon? So now this brings me to the second question. The second question I raised was, why did Yitzchak want to give the blessings to Esav in the first place? Did Yitzchak not know what's going on? So here, let me just mention a number of Mefarshim. The Abarbanel, right, you heard of the Abarbanel? This is Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel. He was one of the great biblical commentators. He was also the finance minister of Spain during the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella. He was the one who financed Columbus's discovery of the New World. And it was during his tenure in 1492 that the Jews were expelled from Spain. On Tisha B'Av, 1492. And because the Abarbanel was the money man, he was given permission, if he wanted to stay in Spain and even be Jewish. I mean, he would remain a religious Jew, but he refused to remain. He went with his brethren. He was at the head of the line because he was the Zaken, the elder, the Gadol Hador for the Jews in Spain. At the back of the line, there was a mother holding the hand of her four-year-old child. And that four-year-old child's name was Yosef Cairo, who grew up to be the author of the Shulchan Aruch. First he went to Turkey, and then he went to Eretz Yisrael, to Tzfat. By the way, just as an aside, as I mentioned, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, unless they converted to Christianity, Primeranos, that occurred in 1492 on Tisha B'Av. But there was a Psak Halacha that year that they should play musical instruments as they were going, that there was a need that their spirits not be broken, that they believe that Hashem will take care of them. Ad kedei kach that the Rabbanim said, what is normally a pretty serious offense, to simply play musical instruments on the 9th of Av, they actually permitted it for that generation. Be it as it may, the Abarbanel is one of our great Mefarshim. The Abarbanel has a unique style of Parshanut, because what he does is, he takes a parak of Chumash, and he'll ask a whole bunch of questions, like 50 questions. And after he asks 50 questions, he then gives you a parak that answers all of the questions. So they tell the story that this could be dangerous. They tell the story about the fellow who used to read the Abarbanel on Shabbos, but he became an apikoros, because after the cholent, he would read 50 questions on the Torah, and then he would fall asleep. So he says, oh, so many questions on the Torah, can't make sense. Okay, so it's dangerous when you have too many questions before you get to the answer. But, okay, that's just an aside. But anyway, on the Haggadah, the Abarbanel asks 100 questions, and not just four, 100 questions, then he explains the Haggadah. But anyway, the Abarbanel actually learns that Yitzchak was naive. And he says he thought Esav was a righteous man. Because Esav, number one, was exemplary in Kibbutz Aviyim. Number two, Esav used to ask religious shaylas. Remember, what is the truma and the maser that you take off from straw and from water and from salt? These are crazy questions, but Yitzchak might have thought, oh, Esav is such a tzaddik. And the Abarbanel makes the point that because Yitzchak was so spiritually elevated from the Akedah experience, he was an otherworldly person. He did not understand duplicity. He did not understand lies. He did not understand deception. When people came to him in the guise of righteousness, he saw them as pure. That is the meaning of the statement. He was blinded by the tears of the Akedah. Right? The angels shed tears at the Akedah, and the Medrash says Yitzchak's eyes were blinded. So metaphorically, what that means is the spiritual heights of being a korban blinded him to the external realities. So the Abarbanel says there was naivete. He actually thought Esav was righteous and deserving of the bracha. But let me mention, there are two questions on the Abarbanel. Because number one, again, I'm going back a little bit because in order to understand this parsha, we need to look at the end of last week's parsha. And I wasn't here, I gave you no shir last week. If you remember, right before Yitzchak asked Esav to go hunting, it mentions Esav married two Canaanite women from the daughters of Ches. Ches was the Canaanite nation. And it says this was very bitter in the eyes of Yitzchak and Rivka, that Esav took Canaanite women, which was so repulsive to the children of Abraham. So clearly, Yitzchak is aware that Esav is doing sinful things. And the second proof that Yitzchak was aware of Esav's sinfulness is that when Yaakov comes with the goat skins and his arms are hairy, so we have the very famous line that Yitzchak says, "Hakol kol Yaakov," the voice is the voice of Yaakov, but the hands are the hands of Esav. So do you remember what Rashi says? Rashi explains it's not that Yaakov had a different voice than Esav. Their voices were the same. They both were twins. They actually had the same voice. But the manner of speaking was distinct, because Yaakov would always mention Hashem's name, and Esav never mentioned Hashem's name. And this man in front of Yitzchak is mentioning Hashem. This is the way Yaakov talks. It's not the way Esav talks. So one second. Isn't this a kasha in the Abarbanel, meaning to say, Yitzchak knows Esav is not so righteous. So this is a kasha on the Abarbanel. So because of this, there are other pshatim that our svarim tell us. One pshat from Rav Gedalia Shor, who was a great, great Rosh Hashiva of Torah Vadas, says the following. Yitzchak certainly knows Esav is not righteous. But what is the meaning of a bracha? A bracha is giving someone a crutch that they'll get special spiritual help from the Almighty. Now remember, if Avraham's dominant characteristic is loving kindness, Yitzchak's characteristic is strict judgment. If you're a person with a personality of strict judgment, you don't want to give crutches to people who can make it spiritually on their own. Yitzchak didn't want to give Yaakov a bracha because he wanted Yaakov to merit all of his righteousness through his work, through his toil, through his effort, because that is the most important. He didn't want to give him a freebie. He didn't want to give him a gift. Esav, precisely because Esav was weaker spiritually, Yitzchak thought, this is what he thought, that I'll give him a bracha to elevate him, that he needs to be handicapped, he needs to be carried a little bit. So it's exactly the opposite. It's precise. Now, Yitzchak still made a mistake that he didn't know Esav was so bad that the bracha wouldn't help. We'll come to that. But the hava amina, to give Esav the bracha, was that a bracha is called a siyua in ruchnius. A siyua is an assistance in spirituality. And he didn't want to give Yaakov that assistance. He wanted Yaakov to make it on his own. Right? That's why we're so mean. We don't allow art scroll in the Beis Medrash or whatever it is. We want you to make it on your own without the crutches or the artificial help or whatever it would be. Right? That's what Rav Yishar says. Now, he says, though, that Yitzchak eventually realized through this whole ruse that the bracha belongs to Yaakov. Rabbi Dalia Shore says that was Yitzchak's Nisayan. See, it's wonderful. What was Avram's Nisayan? Avram's Nisayan is the Midah of Chesed. He had to be cruel. What was Yaakov's Nisayan? The Midah of MS? He had to lie. And what was Yitzchak's Nisayan? That the Midah of Gevura, in which he didn't want to give the crutch to the one who was worthy. But Yitzchak had to acknowledge at the end, Gam Baruch Yiyeh, the blessing belongs to Yaakov. Yitzchak had to be Mevater on his Midah of Gevura to give it to Yaakov. Right? That becomes the Nisayan of Yitzchak himself. You know the story, it's a famous story, I'm sure you may have heard it over the years, where when the Vilna Gaon, Malachim would come to him to offer to teach him the secrets of the Torah. And he refused. He says, I only want the Torah that comes through my work and through my efforts. I don't want the Torah that is given to me as a gift. Right? So that's the idea, that Yitzchak wanted Yaakov to earn his relationship with Hashem and not have a crutch. So at least we offered a perspective, a partial perspective, I understand, on two of the three questions. Number one, how could Yaakov lie? The answer is that was his Nisayon, that God said you have to serve Hashem in all of these ways. Number two, what did Yitzchak think? So Abarbanel says Yitzchak was fooled. Rabbi Dalia Shore says Yitzchak wanted the bracha to go to the one that has the crutch. But there's a pshat of the Malbim that's very, very excellent and very, very interesting. And he points out the following. And again, I apologize for doing last week, but we'll connect it. And that is, there are actually besides the bracha that he gave Esav, but there are actually two blessings that Yitzchak gave Yaakov. One blessing is the blessing he gave Yaakov when he thought he was Esav. But when he thought he was Esav, he gave Yaakov a blessing. And then there's a blessing he did give Yaakov when Yaakov was about to run away to Padan Aram. And right, so there's the blessing of Esav that Yaakov took, and then there's the blessing that was given directly to Yaakov. If you look at the text of the two blessings, you actually see they are very, very different. The blessing of Esav that was mistakenly, so to speak, given to Yaakov was a blessing only of Gashmias. Vayitein lecha Elokim, may a God give you mitala shamayim, from the dew and from the rain, and may nations serve you, etc. It was a blessing of success in Olam Hazeh. Success in terms of fertility, in terms of agriculture, in terms of dominance. But the blessing that he gave Yaakov when he knew he was Yaakov was the blessing, may God give you the blessing that he gave to my father Avraham, which is the spiritual heritage. So here is what the Malbim said. The Malbim says a wonderful thing. The Malbim said, Yitzchak never intended to give a spiritual blessing to Esav. The spiritual blessing that was eventually given to Yaakov would always have been given to Yaakov. But Yitzchak wanted to give Esav the blessings of Eretz Yisrael and Olam Hazeh. Reason? Yitzchak has two sons. He loves them both. They are both his sons. He knows full well that Yaakov is the tzaddik. And he knows that Esav is not the tzaddik. But Yitzchak is looking for some way, it's a tragic figure, some way that Esav could redeem his life and make his life meaningful. He knew he couldn't put Esav in the Beis HaMedrash and tell Esav to learn all day. But he envisioned a type of arrangement that is similar to what we find later between the tribes of Yisachar and Zevulun. Do you remember the idea of Yisachar and Zevulun? Yisachar was a shevet that was devoted to the full-time learning of Torah. Now Zevulun learned also, people make mistakes, Zevulun has to learn Torah too. But Zevulun was involved in commerce, and Zevulun used his physical resources to take care of Yisachar. And in that way, Zevulun becomes a partner in Yisachar's Torah learning and gets an equal portion.
What's the source for creation of this concept of Yisachar and Zevulun?
Yes, this is a Gemara, and it's based on, it's derived from Moshe Rabbeinu's bracha at the end of his life, where it's in Zos HaBracha, where it says, Smach Zevulun Bitseisecha V'Yisachar B'Ohalecha. Rejoice, Zevulun, when you go out, and Yisachar in your tent. So Chazal have a drasha, Zevulun goes out and does business, Yisachar is in the tent of Torah, and they're called equal. This is the partnership of Zevulun and Yisachar. The Chafetz Chaim actually gives a very interesting explanation. Do you remember in the Mishkan, when you have the Aron HaKodesh? So the Aron HaKodesh has poles by which the Levim would carry the Aron, and the Torah makes the point that those poles cannot be removed from the Aron even when the Aron is at rest. Even when the Aron is down, you don't take away the poles. Why is that so? So the Chafetz Chaim explains. The Aron HaKodesh represents Torah. The poles represent the support of Torah. They supported Torah in the journey in this world. Even when the Ark is at final rest, Olam Haba, the poles are with the Ark. So this is what Yitzchak figured. Yitzchak figured, listen, why should I give Yaakov Eretz Yisrael? Why should I give him a political world? Why should I give him all of these things? Let me give Esav all of the physical brachos of the world. And Esav can, you know, build cities, and Esav can conquer, and Esav can use his aggression in constructive ways, and he will use his resources to benefit Yaakov. And then it becomes the Yisachar-Zevulun partnership. Now that's still a mistake. Rivka understood. Too little, too late. Esav is not going to change. That was the thing. But at least according to the Malbim, you understand, Yitzchak was not naive. In fact, it's a very, very moving idea that Yitzchak is looking for some way to salvage Esav's life and give it some holiness. Not by trying to make him a Yaakov, but by letting him use his talents in a good way. Esav had a lot of energy, right? Esav was a go-getter. Esav was somebody who was capable of doing a lot of things. Yitzchak thought they could be channeled to good. Now, Yitzchak's cheshbon was that this was a good thing both for Yaakov and for Esav. It was good for Esav because it gave Esav a constructive way to use his kochos. And it was good for Yaakov because Yitzchak actually felt that, number one, if Yaakov gets involved in building up societies and gets involved in politics and gets involved in building a country, how is he going to learn? How will he think about Hashem? But also, Yitzchak was afraid that because Yaakov was so pure and holy, Yaakov would be destroyed by the falsity of the world. So Yitzchak said, get Yaakov away from it. So Rav Hirsch actually says that the reason Yaakov engaged in deception is he needed to show his father, I too am capable of deception, so I do understand liars. And if I do understand liars, they're not going to destroy me. You see a certain subtlety, meaning I know, not that I will play that game, but I know how to play that game. And because I know how to play that game, I can be entrusted with this responsibility. So these are all of the different cheshbonos in terms of what Yitzchak thought. But again, ultimately, no matter how you cut it, Yitzchak made a mistake. Now the Abarbanel says Yitzchak Stamazai thought Esav was a tzaddik. Okay, but even if you don't go with the Abarbanel, even though the mistake is a more subtle mistake, but it's unavoidable that obviously Rivka was correct over here. But the Medrash makes one final point, and that is, you know, it's a funny thing. We say Yaakov got the brachos. Right? Yaakov got the brachos. Did Yaakov really get the brachos? In other words, do all the nations, you know, serve the Jewish people? The thousands of years of Galus, we haven't gotten the brachos yet. The brachos will be fulfilled only when Mashiach comes. And there's actually a medrash that says, this is an amazing medrash, that because Yaakov got the brachos by deception, even though it was the right thing to do, that is why Yaakov suffers the deceptions in Laban's house, where Laban cheats him over and over again. And that is why Yaakov suffers the deception of 22 years when his beloved son Yosef is torn away from him. When Esav discovers he was a victim of deception, so the pasuk says, "Vayizak zaka gadolu umara," he cried a loud and bitter cry. And that phrase appears only one other place in Tanakh, in Megillas Esther. When Mordechai hears that Haman wants to destroy the Jewish people, "Vayizak zaka gadolu umara," and the Gemara in Megillah says, because Yaakov made Esav have that bitter cry, the descendant of Esav through Amalek, Amalek is Esav's grandson, and Haman is from Amalek, makes the descendant of Yaakov, Mordechai, have the same thing. Pain begets pain. Lying begets lying. And here, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says a very important idea. Let's imagine you have a fire. And generally speaking, you put your arm in fire, unless Hashem does an open miracle, your hand is going to get burnt. Now, does it make a difference if I put in my fire because I was playing a game, or I put my hand in the fire to rescue a baby? I'm going to get burnt either way. Not because I'm being punished. Obviously, if I'm rescuing a baby, I'm not getting punished. It's just the natural, automatic consequence. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, the same way there are natural laws in the physical world, there are natural laws in the spiritual world. And the natural laws in the spiritual world is, when you cause pain to other people, even when it is the right thing to do, even when it's the right thing to do, you're rescuing the baby, you are going to get burnt. The pain that we cause others comes back to us in one way or the other. The pain that Yaakov caused Esav comes back to Yaakov and his descendants. Now, that doesn't mean not to do it. Sometimes you must do it despite the cost. But what is the message? The message is proceed with caution. I mean, practically, for example, sometimes people criticize, make fun of others, denigrate others, and they comfort themselves by saying, my motives are for the sake of heaven. I'm doing it v'shem shamayim. Well, maybe that's true and maybe it's not. Sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. But the point to remember is, even if it's true, you hurt people, it comes back. Now, sometimes you have to make a decision. This is so important, I'm going to do it. Right? Milchama, killing Amalek. You got to do it. But be very, very cautious that whenever you go down the path of causing pain or embarrassment to another human being, it can always come back and bite you, as we see that even with Yaakov Avinu himself, who did what he had to do, he suffered for it. So we shouldn't be too cavalier in invoking, oh, my motives are l'shem shamayim, etc., and the like. Right. So that's an important message. Yeah.
Do we hold the same logic for animals too, like cause pain, suffering to animals?
Well, I don't know if it comes back to you in that way. I mean, it's absolutely clear that there's a great prohibition against causing pain to animals. That's absolutely the case. Whether it comes back to you, well, actually, I'll give you a story that maybe says that it does. All of you heard, of course, obviously, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, right? The author of the Mishnah, one of the greatest of our Chachamim. And the story goes, he was once walking in the street. This is a Gemara in Bava Metzia. And a cow was being led to slaughter. The calf was being led to slaughter, and the calf ran away and tucked its head under his arm as if to seek protection. And he pushed the calf away and he said, go! This is why you were created. This is your job. to get slaughtered. So it mentions, at that moment, it was decreed in Shemayim that Rebbe would suffer excruciating pains for 13 years, for many, many years. In fact, this probably was something like stomach cancer. That seems to be the description, pains in the stomach, intestines, etc. And he suffered tremendously because of this lack of compassion for the animal. And how did it go away? It went away that one time his maid, his shifcha, was cleaning the house. And in those days, dirt floors, they didn't have upholstery and the like. There was a nest of field mice in the house. Again, for modern sensibilities, we kind of feel that's gross, but if you lived in those types of that type of time, it wasn't so bad. But she was going to sweep it away. And he said, no. For Rachamav al kol ma'asav, Hashem's mercy is on everything. And the second he said that, his sickness went away. So there you at least have one example where indeed, in fact, he didn't even cause pain to the animal. He was just less compassionate than he should have been. And that was called causing tsar b'alei chayim. That's why, again, without, this deserves a talk of its own. I'll get your question in a second. I just want to say that the issue of people say, is it moral, is it halachically proper to be a vegetarian? So, putting aside Shabbos and Yom Tov, which is our halachic question, there's no chiyuv to eat meat during the week, certainly. But let me just point out, it all depends on why you want to be a vegetarian. If you want to be a vegetarian because of health, that's fine. If you want to be a vegetarian because you think that killing animals for meat is immoral, that is not good, because Hashem said it's moral. How can you say you're better than Hashem? But, if you don't want to eat meat because you say the way animals are handled before Shechita, being penned up and not being allowed to move, that's cruel. That's perfectly legitimate. That is a legitimate stance because the Torah doesn't really allow you to treat the animals in a bad way before you slaughter them. So if you're against Shechita in principle, that I think would be against the Torah. But if you're against the pre-Shechita cruelty, that would be fine. Did you want to say?
Yes. My question was, what's to explain Yitzchak's trembling at Esau's return?
Well, I think no. I think that this is exactly the point. Meaning, according to what we're saying, Yitzchak knew Esau was not great, but Yitzchak thought Esau was redeemable by giving him the brachas of Olam Hazeh. When Yitzchak shows up, and now when Esav shows up, and now Yitzchak sees spiritually the Gehenna opening up, he realizes, it's a big shock to him, he realizes that Esav is not redeemable at this point. There's nothing that can be done. That Esav is not going to use his resources to help Yaakov, he's only going to use his resources to hurt Yaakov. And that's a tremendous shock. When a father realizes, imagine the pain, when a father realizes that the son, as bad as he was, I thought I could make him good. And when he says, not shaykh.
So why would you say, who was that that was before me? Like, who was that who just came before me?
Well, he's now realizing, well, because he's also learning about Yaakov. I didn't think Yaakov could lie, meaning, who was that person? I didn't even know him. I didn't know you, and I didn't know him. I thought Yaakov was disembodied emes. And now I see Sheker, and I thought Esav had potential righteousness. And now I see there's nothing.
So he didn't know.
So he didn't know at that point. But what I'm saying is, he didn't know either son. He didn't know the capacities of either son to the fullest level. Okay? So this is the kind of the complicated. Now let me just mention one final point. The Nitziv points out a very interesting thing. This sounds like a modern idea. It sounds like a 21st century marriage counseling. But he points out that the style of communication between Avram and Sarah is very different than the communication between Yitzchak and Rivka. When Sarah has a problem with their oldest son, not her, Avram's, right? She talks to him about it. She basically says, hey, Yishmael's a bad guy, we gotta get rid of him. We'll call Sarah direct communication. Rivka has to engage in tricks and strategies. Why doesn't she just talk to her husband? Why does she have to do these games and all of these complicated things, which are spiritually very, very dangerous? The Nitziv says, Rivka was in awe of Yitzchak. It was very, very different. Sarah and Avram were kind of a marriage of equals. The Nitziv says this. They kind of had equality. Sarah was a prophet. Avram was a prophet. Avram converted, you know, brought the men, and Sarah did the women. They really were a team in that way. Rivka, number one, even as a matter of age, the age was very different, right? She was 3 when Yitzchak was 40. There were 37 years between them. Yitzchak had experiences that Rivka could never share. He was an Akedah. He had reached certain levels of holiness and the like. Rivka herself came from an idolatrous home. See, Avram and Sarah came. They also came from an idolatrous home. But they both came, equal background. Rivka came from an idolatrous home. Yitzchak was raised in Kedusha. So then Nitziv says, there was a great, great difference. Rivka related to Yitzchak in a very awe-inspiring way, and as a result, she felt. She had to communicate by indirection, by showing Yitzchak who Yaakov was and who Esav was, etc. So he says it's a very different communication style. Now we're not saying what's better, whatever it is, but he makes the point that Avram and Sarah was a much more direct way of speaking than Yitzchak and Rivka. Okay, see you tomorrow. And
to the kashrut.